Second part of this session, the first talk is given by Christina Hushen from Stanford University. Distinct emergent actin patterns explain diverse parasite gliding modes.
Thank you, Jean-François. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Christina Hushen. I'm a postdoc in Alex Dunn's group at Stanford. It's been incredible to be here. I'm grateful to Thomas and Jean-François for inviting me. And I'm looking forward to sharing with you my work on how distinct emergent actin patterns explain diverse parasite gliding modes. So one of my favorite things about this story is that we'll be using flocking theory, originally developed to explain the collective motion of birds over here on the eukaryotic tree of life, to understand actin organization in Toxoplasma gondii parasite way over here on the other side of the eukaryotic tree, highlighting how math can unify across scales and systems. So Toxoplasma gondii, the star of our show today, is a single cell, a 6 by 2 micron cell. It's a protist, it's parasitic, and it's part of this group of parasitic protists called the ape complexa, which includes Plasmodium species, which caused malaria. And Toxoplasma gondii sits around quietly in the brains of about a third of us humans, more than that here in France, actually. And it does cause life-threatening disease in immunocompromised individuals and in the developing fetus. But the reason that it is the star of this story is because of its motility. So Toxoplasma cells, like other apicomplexan parasites, do not swim or crawl like textbook eukaryotic cells. They glide over substrates without changing shape. So even though I'd been interested actually in malaria research and Plasmodium, I'd never heard of this gliding motility until I was reading a review on cell motility written by Julie and Dan Fletcher. And it had this table on all the ways that cells move. There were 3 entries for eukaryotic cells. There were our 2 familiar favorites, which have showed up much in this meeting, swimming with cilia or flagella, crawling with protrusion and retraction, like you see in this beautiful movie of a human neutrophil, which Julie also showed. But then there was a 3rd entry for eukaryotes, cell gliding, and specifically the gliding of these apicomplexan parasites. And this is also substrate dependent, like crawling, but it does not involve much cell shape change at all. So thinking of this as a rigid body motion on a substrate is a pretty good approximation. And it can also happen at 20 times the speed of that human neutrophil you are watching. So of course I was hooked by this, thinking, you know, how does a single cell speed across a surface without shape changes or cilia? And as I started to dig into the literature and learn more and decided to pursue this question for my postdoc and started culturing and imaging these cells myself, the mystery deepened because Toxoplasma gondii, for example, when moving on a surface, actually shows off this whole diverse collection of movements. Most of these have been characterized for about 2 decades. There's helical gliding, which you see in the top left movie here. The cell is translating, it's moving forward, but it's also rotating. There's also circular gliding, which you see in the top right movie. Interestingly, it's been reported that this happens when the cell is lying on its right side, specifically, if you consider the concave surface of the cell to be its ventral or its ventral surface or stomach. There's also twirling, which happens when the cell is up on its posterior end and it's rotating around, so it's kind of spinning like a top in that bottom left movie. And there are also fast back and forth gliding movements, like you see in the bottom right here. So now, of course, our question becomes, how does a single cell speed across a surface without shape changes or cilia and switch between these 4 different distinct stereotypical gliding modes? So I'll tell you what we know. Because of the work of many groups, beautiful work, we know most of the molecular complexes involved in gliding. And the basic picture that's out there is that there are these actin filaments that flow within this very thin surface layer at the periphery of the cell. So if we zoom in on that here, we have these actin filaments, which I've drawn in purple, that are moving around between this plasma membrane and this inner membrane complex, which is just 25 nanometers above the plasma membrane. So in this quasi-2D channel, these actin filaments are moving around, and they're propelled by this carpet of green myosin motors, which are anchored in this inner membrane complex. So this is actually quite similar in some ways to a traditional in vitro gliding assay, where you have motors stuck down on glass, let's say. They have a carpet of them, and then you have actin filaments crowd surfing on top. But now picture wrapping that kind of around this 3D cell surface, this rigid, stereotyped cell shape. Okay, so now we can refine our puzzle or our mystery a little bit further, and we can ask, how do these actin flows give rise to those four different modes of motility? How are these actin movements patterned or directed in some way to generate coherent traction force and actually move the cell in a directional manner? And the dominant hypothesis that was out there was that perhaps these microtubules, which I've drawn in gray, which lie just below this inner membrane complex and have a defined polarity, perhaps they're somehow giving this polarity to the actin myosin system. They might be directing or organizing these myosin motors so that they're all oriented a certain way, and they pull all the actin filaments rearward. So the model was all the actin flows rearward with respect to the parasite. And then, if the actin catches at a point of contact with the substrate, if it catches on one of these pink adhesin proteins, which is connected to the substrate and therefore held in place, then the actin filaments locally there will be stationary. The myosin motor will instead walk forwards towards the plus end of this actin filament and carry the inner cytoskeleton, the guts of the parasite, forward. So the model was actin flows rearward, myosin and parasite move forwards. But you might already be thinking that there's perhaps a difficulty in reconciling this unidirectional model with that back and forth gliding mode we talked about. And there have been reports from others, for example, here I'm showing you a movie of a Plasmodium sporozoite that's translocating a bead up and down. The movie is a bit washed out, I think, for me, sorry. But these beads we expect to be coupled to these adhesins, and the templated model in which the microtubules are templating this rearward actin flow would predict that the actin and the adhesins only move rearward, and instead we see this bead going up and down and up and down. And if we image Toxoplasma gondii cells quite quickly at a fast frame rate, you'll see them moving back and forth and back and forth in this kind of exciting, violent way. So this is all not quite consistent with this actin-only rearward model, this microtubule templating model. And that model might also lead us to expect if the microtubules were somehow orienting or patterning these myosins, the myosin might localize only below the microtubules. But if we image with super-resolution microscopy, we can look at these microtubules, and then we can look at the myosin motor, and it seems to be quite uniformly located throughout the cell surface, not just below these green microtubules. So we had some reasons to doubt some things about this previous model, and we wanted to test it more directly by imaging actin in this system and simply seeing, does actin always flow rearward? Does it follow the path of the microtubules? And to do this, we adapted approaches for live single-molecule imaging to the Toxoplasma gondii system. And that allowed us to image individual molecules of myosin light chain and actin moving around within live Toxoplasma cells in between gliding movements by TURF microscopy. In a way, this approach is relatively simple. The basic trick is to express these tag proteins at extremely low levels. I'm using the weakest Toxoplasma promoter that I could find anywhere. And then I'm labeling it with a very bright photostable dye, but at very, very low concentrations. So I end up with just a handful of molecules per cell, which you see in cyan here. And when we watched myosin moving around, we frequently saw molecules that were stationary or immobile. They seemed bound for up to tens of seconds. So this is consistent with myosin's anchorage in that inner membrane complex that I told you about. And when we watched actin molecules moving around, some of them were stationary, likely in bound filaments, like this one currently labeled by the arrowhead, which sticks around for about a second before unbinding. We also saw a population of actin molecules that were meandering around, likely diffusive filaments. And we saw some fast directional actin transport events, like you see in the bottom right there. And when we focused in on this fast directional or ballistically moving population, we found that it moved at a speed of about 5 microns per second. So this is actually quite similar to speeds measured for purified toxoplasma myosin A in vitro by Angelica Arum Goetz. And then most strikingly, we saw that these directional actin transport events were not uniform with respect to the cell polarity. So these tracks that you see are not moving only rearward following the path of the microtubules. They seem to really be quite heterogeneous. And so that led us to wonder, of course, if it's not the microtubules that are organizing the actin, telling it how to polarize, telling it how to move, then what does organize the actin? And here I was really, really getting into this puzzle. I was watching these movies I was taking of toxoplasma moving around and just staring at them and thinking, okay, when this part of the cell is in contact with the substrate, it moves in this direction, so the traction force on that part of the cell must be in this direction, and that would mean the actin polarity would be like this and flow this way, and I was buying all these plastic bananas online and drawing all these putative flow patterns on them, carrying them around campus. I even had a very failed brief foray into building macroscopic banana robots, which were nothing like the beautiful swimmers we saw this morning. And then eventually I started wondering, okay, maybe there's a very simple answer to what patterns these flows. And even though I had not yet heard Robert Insull's Bob May quote about self-organization, I started wondering if these patterns or flows, this actin polarity, was self-organized, as in many other cytoskeletal systems or actomyosin systems. So what exactly do I mean by self-organized in this context? Well, let's picture that you take a glass slide and stick down a carpet of myosin motors and add filaments and ATP on top, as the Bausch group did in this movie. The filaments will be moved around by the motors, they'll interact with other filaments, and large-scale patterns like this one can emerge. So there's nothing on the glass slide here that's templating this swirling pattern. It's arising by self-organization. So we wanted to take this hypothesis seriously, try to really pursue it, and to us that meant trying to figure out if we knew about these short-range interactions, local interactions between motor-propelled filaments, and we thought about those happening on the surface of this very this cell that's very stereotyped in shape, what kinds of actin patterns would we expect to arise? Can we predict emergent actin polarity and velocity patterns and connect those to these cell motility behaviors? And of course, to do this, we needed a mathematical, model of these local interactions, these short-range interactions. So we thought first about what we know about the molecular scale biology in this situation. What are the things that we want to mathematicize in order to develop a model of toxoplasma actin filament self-organization? So first, we know that these filaments are transported by myosins. And because these are plus-end-directed motors, we know that these filaments are going to move in the direction that their minus-end points. We also think that they move at the speed at which myosin motors walk, so I'm going to call that V myosin. We also think that filaments interact with their neighbors through cross-linking interactions and steric effects and collisions, and so we expect that there's some alignment between local filaments. We also think that filaments are kept within a certain range, let's say a realistic range. Certainly we don't want negative densities or a physically high ones. And then fourth, we are hypothesizing that there's a penalty for filament alignment in a direction of high curvature. and a preference for alignment like this. And that assertion is based on estimates of a non-trivial bending energy given actin's persistence length and our knowledge of actin filament length and cell curvature in this system. So those are kind of our molecular scale rules that we have in mind. And to mathematicize them, we drew on continuum active matter theory, and in particular what's called Turner 2 flocking theory, originally developed to understand the beautiful collective motions of birds or these sheep, which are now your friends that you saw this morning as well, or schools of fish. And we are going to draw on this Turner 2 flocking theory in order to build a model of actin filament self-organization in toxoplasma. In other words, equations that describe the time evolution of two field variables, filament density, rho, and filament velocity, v, which is capturing both filament orientation and speed here. Okay, so in a sense, we want these equations that are going to tell us how these two quantities update over time. And let me walk you through the math of this. So we start off in a regime in which filaments are stabilized. No filament turnover is allowed. And that means that filament density, rho, it changing over time is regulated simply by the continuity equation. So we're just keeping track of density moving around in space and not allowing new density to appear out of nowhere or disappear. Then for our governing equation for velocity, we have a minimal version of the Turner 2 model. So first, we remember that filaments are transported with their minus ends leading. And they move at the speed v myosin. So if filament speed gets too high, this beta term will push it back down. If it gets too low, this alpha term will push it up. Filaments also align with their neighbors. So mathematically, this is a diffusion of velocity, essentially. Then we have a pressure-like term. This is a pressure equation of state relating pressure and density. Is going to keep our filament density in a realistic range. And then finally, we have a new term relative to standard flocking theory, which penalizes filament alignment in a direction of high curvature. Here, D1 is a unit vector in the direction of maximum curvature. It's going to prefer alignment like this. Filaments are going to rotate with some relaxational dynamics that's a function of the local curvature here and the orientation of the filament. Okay, so we have our model. It's one thing to solve these equations on a planar geometry, but we want to actually solve it on the curved surface of the real toxoplasma cell. And so we used extrinsic differential geometry in order to reformulate the Turner 2 flocking equations into a general curved space formulation that can handle arbitrary curved geometries. You could think of this approximately as doing calculus by projecting all our variables and all our calculus operators into this tangent plane using the local normal vector. So all we need is this field of normal vectors, and then we can solve these equations using the finite element method. And we can do it for the real toxoplasma cell shape or a non-spherical cow even, for example. And actually, this is your brief intermission entertainment, so you can tune out for 5 minutes if you need a mental break. We got very excited about this approach and kind of its versatility, and so we had a lot of fun also exploring flocking behavior in fun geometries like this channel flow around an obstacle where if you put in an obstacle of big enough radius, you start to get the flock reversing or reflecting off this obstacle, and you can look at that transition as a function of, let's say, obstacle size. We had some fun with flocks on a sphere, flocks going over a Gaussian hill, flocks on this Jurassic Park-like island geometry that, for us, inspires kind of our, or kind of paints this vision of our excitement about using practical approaches like this to bridge continuum active matter theory and real-world geometries and boundary conditions. Okay, so back to toxoplasma. We have our general surface formulation of our 202 equations. Now we're going to solve it on these beautiful 3D cell surfaces, which we obtained from soft X-ray tomograms of extracellular toxoplasma parasites. We turned these into meshes. We can then solve our equations. Oh, sorry, I should have said this is in collaboration with Liav Segev-Zarko, working with John Hua Chen in Carolyn Larabell's group. We then can solve our equations using the finite element method and start to generate predictions for actin organization. Let me tell you a bit about these predictions, about our results. So first, you'll remember we're in this regime where filaments are stable. There's no filament turnover. And in that case, if we start with a disordered initial condition and we let our filament density and velocity fields according to our update rules, according to our self-organization equations, what emerges are these dense patches of actin, the redder colors, that recirculate up and down and up and down the cell indefinitely. And one thing that's fun is we can do experiments where we overstabilize actin filaments, and then we see these protrusions, these bundles of actin that recirculate up and down and up and down the cells. So let me play that step by step. Since this is in turf, the big bundle of actin sometimes goes out of plane, but hopefully you can make it out. Here it's moving down the cell. Now it's going to move back up the cell. Now it comes back down, and so on. Okay, but of course, under normal conditions, without this drug around, we actually know that actin filaments in toxoplasma turn over quite quickly, and that actin polymerization is favored specifically by proteins like this formin that are at the anterior end, the apical end of the cell. So we wanted to incorporate this anterior polymerization and depolymerization throughout the cell into our model. So now we have a slightly updated equation for density, which includes this polymerization rate, C, and this filament depolymerization rate, gamma. And now that we allow filament depolymerization and polymerization, we can access a new set of solutions, like the one you see here, in which the filament density and velocity fields are able to reach a steady state. So this movie is still playing, but it has reached a steady state. Actin filaments are continuously flowing rearward down this cell. Let me play it again. And one way to think about what's going on here is that filaments are depolymerizing before they get to the end of the cell and pile up and force a recirculation. So we could also think about this, say, in terms of this dimensionless ratio, which is the ratio of two time scales. One is the time it takes an actin filament to reach the end of the cell. So that's V myosin, L cell over V myosin. And another time scale, which is 1 over gamma. That's the lifetime of a filament. Okay, so we can think about that gives us a bit of intuition for what governs this transition. All right. So that all leads us to a hypothesis, which is that these two distinct emergent actin states give rise to the different parasite gliding modes that you saw in those opening movies. So when an actin steady state emerges, like the one you see here, which is predicted for an intermediate actin depolymerization rate, we can look at these actin velocity patterns, and we can think about what parts of the cell are in contact during these different motility modes. So for example, helical gliding initiates when the left anterior of the cell is in contact with the substrate. So we can look here in our actin velocity pattern, and we can infer a rough traction force, orientation of traction force, this blue arrow, which is opposite to our actin velocity or polarity direction. And then we can think about how the cell would be translated and rotated by that arrow, attraction force, the new contact point that would arise, and so on. And this allows us to see that this particular actin pattern for this higher depolymerization rate is consistent not only with helical gliding, but with circular gliding, which you'll remember happened when the cell's right side is in contact with the substrate, and twirling, where this vortical pattern at the cell posterior would be predicted to generate torque consistent with that rotation. then you'll remember that lower rates of actin depolymerization, this back and forth actin movement emerged, and we think that could explain these back and forth gliding observations. I'm particularly excited about how we can use our model to tune actin depolymerization on the x-axis here and actin polymerization on the y-axis in order to better understand previously puzzling experimental observations in which these same knobs were tuned experimentally. So for example, this actin depolymerizing factor had been knocked out in experiments that we'd expect to move us to the left in this kind of phase space. Or actin mutations had been made which stabilized filament formation, which we'd expect to move us up in this phase state. And in both of those cases, more back and forth gliding had been observed. So back and forth gliding was dominating. And we think perhaps that this transition to more back and forth gliding we can understand as a switch into this recirculating actin space. So this helps us to bring together some kind of puzzling, disparate experimental results. Okay, so if you take away two things from this talk, I hope that will be that actin can self, if we think about emergent flocking patterns that could self-organize on the toxoplasma cell surface, we get these really interesting patterns that are consistent with known parasite gliding modes, and what patterns emerge depends on actin turnover rate. And if we zoom out just a little bit further even to put this story in context, I'll remind you that we talked about these amazing parasitic cells that have this surface layer of actin filaments that drives their motility. We used some microscopy, we used continuum flocking theory to bridge up to the cellular scale and to generate flocking patterns or actin flow patterns that we predict and which we think can help us understand these parasite gliding modes that puzzle this. That was to remind me that to say that I just got this up on BioArchive last week, so if you want to check out details, you can do that. Maybe I'll also add super quickly that for this crowd, both Manu and Kirsty had mentioned diatom gliding, which there are some fun similarities there, and also desmids, which are a single-celled eukaryotic plant, essentially, can show gliding motility, and these kind of haven't been brought together or thought about under the same physical umbrella, at least for many decades, and I think they're kind of deserving of a real treatment and attempt to unify from a physical perspective, like the other modes of eukaryotic cell motility have gotten. So I'll just say a big thanks to the great team of mentors, collaborators, and colleagues who made this work possible, especially Liav Segev-Zarco and John Boothroyd, who really helped me get going with the toxoplasma system and culturing and doing some genetic manipulation in my lab. Rob Phillips, I collaborated with on the theory and modeling, and then my home group, Alex Dunn and the Dunn Lab for their cytoskeletal and imaging expertise. And thanks so much for listening.
Thank you very much.